Hello everyone and welcome to the next edition of the VTX podcast. Here at the Veterinary Thought Exchange, we like to start by asking, what are you thinking? And this week we're going to be thinking and chatting with the wonderful Edwina, who is the veterinary lead from Zoetis UK. Edwina gives us a really valuable and interesting insight into her career as an industry vet and the amazing opportunities that that brings, highlighting again, I think, the amazing opportunities overall that are available to us with our veterinary passport. And importantly, she also addresses some of the common misconceptions that we maybe have regarding veterinary professionals that are working in positions in industry and potentially for pharmaceutical companies. I'm really, really thrilled to say that this episode and actually this series of podcasts has been really, really kindly supported by Zoetis. I just have to mention that our content is intended for members of the veterinary profession, and by continuing to listen, you confirm that this describes you. I'm really, really thrilled also to be joined by another member of the Zoetis team, the lovely Louise, and in our clinical segment today, we're going to be chatting about all things parasite related. So I do hope you can join us for that as well. Right, Edwina, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. It's a real honour to have you here. I wonder if you can start just for our listeners, describing a little bit about you, you know, what your current role is, but how your kind of veterinary journey began as well, if that's okay.
Yeah, of course, Scott, and thanks for having me. So as it stands today, I lead the companion animal veterinary team within Zoetis, and that comprises of a team of field vets, as well as a team of head office vets. And within my role, I also kind of manage part of the portfolio, the pain portfolio. So that's where I am today, but it's been a long journey to this point, and I guess also an unpredicted journey. So setting out, I qualified as a vet in Dublin, and at that point in time, many years ago, I probably thought, or my views were, that I would be a large animal vet in Ireland, and my journey has kind of taken many twists and turns to working in foot and mouth, to working in mixed practice, both livestock and companion animal, and then my journey kind of turned into the pharmaceutical world when one of the reps suggested I should apply for a position. So it's very much open for change, for anything new. And I thought it would be something that I would do for a year or two, which turned out to be 18 years ago. So quite a long time. And within the role within Zoetis, I have worked within the field as kind of customer facing, and then within the head office position, and then on to the position I hold now as a veterinary lead. So many different angles on the veterinary profession, and none of which I would change, actually. And I guess probably the shift from practice to the pharmaceutical industry, it was one that it was just an opportunity. It wasn't, dare I say it, intentional. But I saw it, I thought it'd be interesting and went for it. But I still enjoyed practice at the time, and continued to work in that practice, even though I was still in industry. So I continued that. It changed what I was about to do.
When did you, so just remind us, so you qualified from Dublin, and when was it that you qualified, if you don't mind sharing that?
Yeah, no, it's all no, 2000. So I graduated in 2000, and then that was just before foot and mouth.
Oh God, right. And yeah. what were your, I mean, as far as your you know, ideas going into vet school, what was your kind of ambition? What was your dream? What was your idea of what your veterinary degree would give you as far as a working life? What was your expectation, and what did you expect it to turn into, which is clearly different from what it's ended up being? But what were your expectations going into vet school and then heading out into your first jobs?
Yeah, so I guess my experience started before I went into vet school itself. My sister, she was a vet. I'd worked in a local vet practice, so I could see what that looked like, and that's probably set me up for what I thought I would do. That was a livestock practice at home in Ireland. I enjoyed the work they did. I'd spent time with my sister. And also then from the scientific perspective, going through university, that I was very much interested in the whole science behind it, the learning, the problem solving. And then when I went out into practice, it kind of dare I say, it was what I thought, because I had a lot of kind of exposure beforehand. So my exposure probably started from the age of 12, but that was more livestock. So I guess that's what I thought I would be doing. But then once getting into the real world, I was exposed to many other sides to the profession that I wasn't necessarily aware of, but actually found quite interesting. So I think that's how I ended up coming through vet school and into, dare I say, the real world. I was probably lucky that I had that experience beforehand, which I was aware of the out of hours, the being on call, the livestock side of it. But I guess that was a different world than it is today. So a new grad coming out today is facing a different world than I did back in 2000.
And do you think, I mean, I don't know whether I don't want to stereotype, but I think I wonder, is there a difference, do you think, you know, a lot of the vets I've spoken to that have practiced, you know, in Ireland, do you think there is a sort of different expectation as far as the, you know, the roles of vets? Correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of vets maybe are more involved in the kind of livestock side of things rather than companion animal, or am I being really, really sort of generalizing a whole country of people? But I do feel like there maybe is more of a bias towards that. Would that be accurate, do you think? Is that more of the culture?
Definitely back in 2000, yeah, the experience probably would have been more leaning towards livestock. But I think with everything else, like the world has evolved, companion animals has massively increased globally, and with that, in every world there's a bigger focus. So again, within the cities there's a huge shift, and even in the rural environment, companion animals are things that are driving veterinary practices as well. So practice itself has evolved quite a lot since I qualified in 2000. And I think, again, another aspect within Ireland where I see a difference was that even dealing with companion animal cases and clients, we were used to paying for our own health service as a kind of a human. Dare I say, if you went to the doctor, you paid for that visit to the doctor, then you paid for your medication. So there was an understanding of the actual cost. So I think there is a difference there. That's one of the things I experienced, a difference whenever we moved to Scotland, was that the awareness of the cost of things. If people went to the vet in Ireland, they were aware there was a cost, just like going to the GP and indeed the medications. So I think there's a difference there in relation to the expectations as well of the client base.
Oh, do you? I didn't realize that. So do you pay for healthcare? Oh my God, right. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. And then if you skip across the border, like it's then free at the point of care.
Yes, yeah. So in Ireland, you will have cases where, as in people who will have a medical card, etc., old age pensioners, they will get free access to the GP and to a certain extent their medication. But to the average person who's working day in, day out, they would pay to see their GP. They would then get their prescription and they'd go to the pharmacy and pay for the medication. So there was an understanding there. There is access to hospitals, which... Yeah. Not necessarily paying for your surgery, etc. If you obviously, like in any situation, you can go private, but that standard first exposure to the healthcare system you do pay for, or the majority of people do pay for.
I mean, it's not the topic. I think that's really interesting, and it's a debate that rages on, you know, as far as you know, whether that might be something that changes in the NHS in the UK. But anyway, that's for another day. That's very interesting. But I think, so you know, as far as, you know, you're going back to that idea of veterinary medicine, you know, did you think that you would just be a practicing vet, you know, working in, you know, livestock or whatever else? I mean, was that your expectation of what your veterinary degree would give you as far as when you first came out of vet school?
Yeah, when I came out of vet school, that's what I thought I would do. And I did start off in that kind of journey. It did obviously then take a bit of a detour with kind of foot and mouth hitting. That changed what everybody could do within the profession. So I think without that, I don't know where my journey would have gone. But and I guess that what you're exposed to is what sets your kind of your understanding or your beliefs. My exposure was to livestock, large animal practice, my sister being a large animal vet, etc. So that's what I knew. But it wasn't that I was averse to other things. It was just, it was what I knew and therefore what I would thought I would kind of move into. So
I think it's, I've never, and again, it's probably just a representation of the people that I speak to, but I've never heard someone say, you know, but then foot and mouth hit, so that changed everything. I think I understand as an outsider, you know, watching the news, I understand that foot and mouth had a devastating impact on farmers, on people's life and livelihoods. But I don't think I've ever appreciated maybe that the effect it had on the veterinary sector in that way. So tell me why foot and mouth changed everything for you?
Yeah, I guess it was more what it not forced me to do, but where I ended up moving to. So I moved to Scotland. The practice I'd worked in had been bought over by two vets who had kind of relatively recently qualified, and they had a bill to pay back in essence. And a lot of the finance that would have come through at that point in time would have been through TB testing, which naturally stopped. So the revenue coming through the practice and also the access to the farms dropped. So myself and one of the other assistants, basically there wasn't going to be a job. So we naturally moved to Scotland at the time, where they were kind of needing vets. So we moved to Scotland, and over that time, I recognized my experience was large animal, but then I wanted to expand my experience. So as I kind of got out into the real world, I kind of recognized where my strengths were and where I needed to fill those gaps we talk about. So I kind of, my intention was then to get companion animal practice experience, and then moving to Scotland, which again was a new experience for me, having worked in foot and mouth, moved into different parts of working in Dumfries and then up to Ayr, I recognized the next step was to look at where I could get companion animal experience, and that happened to be in Glasgow. So it was one of those movements that wasn't planned but just evolved, and I probably wouldn't have taken that step or looked to Glasgow for a practice to work in had I not actually moved because of foot and mouth. So, and again, exposed me to vets across the world who've carried out different things. So I think that was also a key part of that process.
All good stories end up in Glasgow. That's where I'm from.
Hello.
where did you work in Glasgow?
In Taylor Vets in Caskin.
Yeah, of course. Exciting. And do you live in Glasgow now?
No, not anymore. I lived in Glasgow and then I moved to Edinburgh, and now I live in Dollar. So I've kind of moved a bit around.
Up in the world.
Well, more to the sticks.
I would say that's as far as Scottish standards, that's an upward trajectory, in my opinion. That's really interesting. That's really interesting. So, do you, as far as kind of the, I'm trying to sort of think what that's similar to. You know, as far as I think, you know, large animal sort of vet making that transition into companion animal. What's that like? I mean, is that stressful? Is that a stressful thing to do, or was that a seamless transition from one to the other?
I think I do have to kind of anyway call out the colleagues I had in Taylor Vets, because they made it very easy for me, and maybe that's a degree of naivety on my behalf at that point in time. What you don't know, you're not necessarily scared of. But there's a great team there, and you always had the help and support. I think that's always a key thing. So even though they had livestock within that practice as well, which I covered, but kind of the majority of the work was companion animal, but you had the support. So I wasn't daunted by it. And I guess that's also youth, dare I say it, if I was to do something.
I think that's true. Like it's just, there's a bravery in being young, don't you think? Like just like, there really is. I genuinely do think that's a real thing. And so I think, yeah, the advice is, if you're going to make any big changes, then do it when you're young, because as you get older, it becomes harder for so many reasons, doesn't it? But I was thinking, like, I think if you ask me today, you know, I'm so, you know, de-skilled in so many things doing the job I do. But if you were to ask me today to go to Ireland, oh my God, and actually, it would be quite funny. It would be the kind of thing that you'd film for a reality TV show. But if you asked me to go to Ireland and become a large animal livestock vet, I mean, it would be comical for so many reasons. But I wouldn't even know where to start. Like, it's just, it's wild to me. So it's quite extreme because, you know, going from what I do to that, but I do think there has to be a bravery in making those sorts of choices, because I think that that's a lot. So that was a brave thing to do, I think, right?
Well, yeah, looking back on it now, if I was to kind of do the same again at this stage of my life, I probably would be more hesitant and more self-critical and kind of cautious, where I do think there is that, should I use the term, unconsciously incompetent, and I didn't know what I didn't know. And I was not fearful, and I wasn't afraid to ask either. So I think that is youth, whether you look at it as a young vet student or a child, they don't think there's anything that they can't do. It's just, especially a child, it's a matter of how they get it done. I've got a 7-year-old son, it's like he can do anything. In his head, he can drive. And if you give him the chance, he would. So there's with age comes, I guess, experience. And because if experiences then impact your risk taking, yeah. I guess. So,
and as far as then, you know, making that move into, you know, we talk about industry. I don't know. There's something about that when I was thinking about that term. There's a certain way we speak about different things, isn't there, in the veterinary profession? And like, let me give you a joking example. I am genuinely joking, but so when I speak to you and your colleagues from Zoetis, like, you'll say things like portfolio, right? Okay.
That's new language.
I'm like, do you know what I mean? I'm being kind in my joke there, but you know, you'll say the portfolio is one that stands out, you know, like. And I love that language is different. Anyway, we can talk about that. But so you're then making this move into industry. And I love that kind of term, actually, because what does that really mean? You know, we talk about industry, but I presume what we're really meaning is drug companies, or, you know, drug companies mainly, actually, probably. And so, you know, vets are then making that move from clinical practice into this other industry. It sounds very grand, industry. You know, and that's, you know, people are making that decision for lots of different reasons. I don't know, can you tell us a little bit about that reasoning, that decision making? Was it conscious, or did you kind of just stumble upon that, or?
I, to be honest, for me, I did stumble upon it, and I know other people, and that might sound unfair, where some people do actively want to get in, and it's not necessarily as easy these days as it was previously. I stumbled across it. I used to deal with a lot of the reps that would come into the practice, and I also used to do a lot of educational talks for our clients. It was a thing I liked to do. And I think that kind of flagged it with one of the reps. So when a job did come up in what was Pfizer at the time, Pfizer Animal Health, he flagged it with me, and basically encouraged me to apply. Now, it's probably because he wanted a finder fee, but he, and this is showing my age. It was the day whenever he said, "Have you looked at it in the vet record?" And I was like, well, usually by the time I get to read the vet record, it's well out of date. It sits on the desk and you pick it up, and it could be several weeks out of date. So no, I haven't seen it or had a chance to look at it. So he faxed it into the business, and said, make sure your bosses don't find it. So I got it. I applied for it, and it actually was a livestock position that I'd applied for. And they had livestock positions and companion animal positions at the time. And it was around the time they were launching Convenia. So there's a big focus in that area. And so I applied for it. And they then said, well, I know you applied for the livestock. Would you consider companion animal? And I thought, why not? So it wasn't kind of something that was set out on my plan of this is what I was going to do, work X number of years in practice and move to industry. It wasn't even a job I realized existed, if I'm honest. It was more just through my interactions with the reps that came into the practice. And they recognised I kind of enjoyed that teaching part of it. So, I ended up then moving to industry, or industry as we refer to it now. But and I didn't know what it would entail. I thought, I'll give it a go. I'll see if I like it. I might be here for a year or two. I remember saying that to one of the bosses, and I think they were a bit surprised at how flippant I was. But I really didn't know what it would be about and whether it would be for me. I did have a little bit of imposter syndrome when you come into what was like a large blue chip company, not knowing what to say or what to do. But yeah, it's been a great experience to say I'm still there.
But well, exactly. You're still there, and we don't fax things anymore, just FYI. But just in case you didn't get that memo. But so I love that, though. I love that. That's a wonderful timestamp of...
How long ago it was.
But it's funny because I was examining last week, and we were talking about our different experiences at residency, and I was saying, well... We used to take our referral letters to our senior clinician. They would correct them with like a pen or a pencil. We would then get the final copy and we would fax them to the referring vet. So that's how we communicated our referral letters. So that, I think the faxing is a really nice way of sort of time stamping something. I must admit, I have one of my really good friends is in industry, working for a different company, Elanco, and he and I are really good friends, and we shared a flat at vet school and we're still good friends now. And I genuinely am like, as you were talking, I was like, you know, I was thinking, I don't 100% know what he does, right? So I know he works for industry, and he definitely does Zoom calls and sometimes leaves the house. I think he's in a management position, but I don't really know what he does. And so in my ignorance, I must admit that when we talk about industry, I think of reps, I think of people being in practice, I think of people coming with a lunch and telling us about a new drug, and that's what I think. And that's really ignorant and not representative of what industry is. So what I'm saying is clearly not accurate, but
part of it is.
Okay. Okay. But isn't that's just like, I feel that that's really unfair. I'm unfairly representing what people do. So I think if that's my understanding, I suppose, can you give us a little bit more of an accurate insight into what that industry really means for a veterinary professional?
Yeah, and I guess that's what you've said is actually part of industry, or the pharmaceutical industry, and that's the part the majority of vets in practice or in university will be exposed to, is that person coming in. But there is a lot more behind that, and not every company has the same structure, but for us in Zoetis, there is a huge kind of veterinary medical kind of team, and that team, the team I kind of manage and lead is the companion animal team, but we also have livestock, we've got pig and poultry, we've got equine, we've also got a diagnostics pillar as well, where we've got, there's me using the terms pillar, another corporate term.
Pillar, pillar, good.
And again, we've got vets within those roles. So There are a lot of vets in, dare I say it, veterinary specific roles. There's also vets in many other positions within the businesses that don't require medical knowledge, but they have come in through maybe a medical position and discovered a part of the business that they are interested in, and they pursue that further. But from a medical team perspective and the structure we have, we've got vets, what we refer to in the field. So there are vets who will be working in specific regions with their account managers. And they support their account managers in their education, but they also then work with specific practices. There is a focus on the products naturally, but the veterinary team tend to look to expand more around the disease area, bring further knowledge to those practices. And our teams, they aren't, as in the team I cover, we're not specialists. We are very much generalists, but generalists who have had practice experience. So we can understand the challenges of practice and the challenges of certain diseases, and we try to actually merge that with what we do and how we try to educate, but also feed that knowledge into, for example, the marketing teams. So again, as I mentioned, we've a field vet team, we've got vets in what we refer to as head office positions or national veterinary managers that will cover, in brackets, a portfolio. So for example, dermatology or pain or parasitics. So they will actually then work with our field team, but also with our marketeers around development of materials. So what we can and what we cannot say. So there'll be statements we have to kind of validate. Is that true? Can we actually say it? Is there evidence to back that up? But also, what is it that actually will support people who will use whatever our products are? How will we support their knowledge around that area, and where those products fit? So that's kind of, dare I say, the obvious part of the rules. But then, depending on the company you work with Zoetis, we've always had a very, very healthy pipeline of products, and that has kept us really busy. And dare I say, that's kept me here going year on year, and because it's made it really interesting and constantly learning, because we've products coming through the pipelines. And part of that process is to what we refer to as develop the market. So there'll be certain areas that products have never existed, or there has been a huge kind of period between a product arriving and a new product, an innovative product arriving, and the focus of the veterinary profession may have kind of died down a little bit. So bringing them up to speed, developing that market around, for example, we talk about the pain pathway, the new learnings around that, the work that we've gone into developing people's understanding of nerve growth factor. Before a product ever arrived, we were trying to bring out that message so people understood. You may have learned it in vet school, but I can put my hand up and say I can't remember, even if we did learn it in vet school. So there's always that gap between what we've learned in vet school and what's happened between that point and where we're at. So the veterinary teams are very much behind all this education as well, and working with key opinion leaders to understand what is happening at the academic side. So it's multifaceted.
And it is really interesting, actually, just, you know, touching on some of the, you know, chats I've had with your colleagues about sort of dermatology products. I mean it genuinely is fascinating as far as the drug development is crazy and super interesting, you know, and I think it's that innovation piece, you know, that innovation piece. That sounds, I see, I'm speaking like I've got the lingo, you see. Do you like that? That was another thing that someone piece, you know, this. I it's so interesting, isn't it, the difference in language. And again, I don't want you to think I'm taking the piss. It's interesting. It's just interesting. I think one of the things that I probably, again, you know, misconception of mine would be that if you were to sort of say to me, there's a job, you know, a job in industry is something, you know, let say you're starting as some sort of rep, you know, going into practices talking about a drug, I suppose I would worry personally that it was salesy. Mm-hmm. Like I would be like, I don't know about that. Like, feels like I'm just selling something, you know, like is it, and the other thing I'd be like, what a hard gig, you know, to be given a bag of learning material, and a PowerPoint presentation and be sent out into the lion's den or whatever the phrase is, you know, into practices and just rock up with some sandwiches and be like, right, I'm here to talk about this. You know, I think you know, I wonder whether on face value it sounds like quite a hard gig. You know, it feels salesy. It feels like we're there's a bit of an uphill battle there. Do you, how would you kind of dispel that misconception? Yeah. Sure, you know.
Yeah, well, I guess what, and I don't have to actually say it to my team. They come with that mindset of they're not, although a product will sell at the end of the whole kind of strategy, in a way, they're coming to provide a solution to a problem that they, and that solution they really, really believe in. And I think we're fortunate with the type of products that we have within Zoetis, that they're really kind of excellent, innovative products that have provided kind of solutions. And I think the feedback kind of is telling on that. So I think from that perspective, if people see you coming in to try and push something that you don't believe in, I think that comes across. I think if you come in with the approach that this is about improving animal health, and I think from a medical team and from the business perspective, actually, that's what we set out to do. And the product is part and package of that. So that's where we look at, this is a problem or this is a situation within a certain disease, and we all want to improve upon that. And this is how we feel we could do that. So you're not, although you're selling a product at the end of it, or the product fits within that, as a medical professional, you are looking to make an impact. So And I think the good example that I use at the moment is in the pain area, we're looking to increase the level of diagnosis of osteoarthritis in cats and dogs, whether we're within the company or whether you're a vet in practice or a nurse in practice. That would actually be our aim. We're not going to say that we're not trying to do that. And also then sustain the management of that. And how can we work with people to help achieve that? The product is a part and package of it, but it's not the only part. And I think when people see that, they see the value you're bringing. So it's the value you're bringing and that actually you have a common kind of purpose or a common agenda and that you're working together on it. So that's where it's, you're providing a solution as opposed to selling. I think the term selling sometimes is like a dirty word, but it's actually a solution. And you do it day in, day out in practice. The client comes in, and I think it's getting your head around that. If you're in a vet in a consult room, and I know clients might say you're trying to sell them something, you're actually trying to provide a solution, the best solution for their pet with the best of intention. So that involves a transaction at the end of it for that service, but it's a solution that you're kind of providing to a problem and leading to a better outcome, because that's kind of what we entered the profession to do. Whether you're in practice or in industry. And I think that's the one thing I've said to people before. People say, oh, you're not a vet anymore. And I would be quite confident to say, well, actually, I am a vet. I'm just using my skill set in a different area. I'm maybe not helping individual pets within the consult room, or not now that I'm not in practice these days, but on a grander scale, helping to bring these products to the market for practices to use and vets and nurses to use and clients and pets to benefit from. I feel I'm actually making a difference. And I think that's where the team feel what they're doing is still very much related to being a vet, but just on a grander scale in a slightly different way than it would have perceived.
I think it's really important to say that with confidence and to be, you know, understanding of the importance of that. I was speaking to a colleague yesterday, a very much a personal call, you know, another internal medicine specialist who was, you know, has been out of practice, has been, you know, doing telemedicine, and, you know, a real feeling, and I did telemedicine for a while, real feeling of not being a proper vet because you weren't in a clinic. And I think that we really must get away from that. You know, we bring value in so many different ways. And I think that's really, really powerful and really, really important. And I think what you said there, which I think is just, again, a great point, is the fact that there is, you know, this salesy thing. You know, we're not, there's a transaction at the end of all of this, sadly. Not sadly. There's a transaction at the end of all of this, you know, and I think that there's no getting away from that. Money is involved here, people, you know, like, I mean, that's, and you know, at the moment, even more topical than ever, but money is involved here. We're not going to move away from that anytime soon. And so, you know, focusing on that, you know, that piece where we talked about, you know, a solution driven approach, I think is really, really great. And at the end of the day, you know, the vets and nurses in practice at the coalface, they're not, you know, they genuinely are not in it for the money. You know, it's about the solution. You're absolutely right. Regardless, you know, a lot of this difficult discussion we have around money and pricing and charging at the moment, you know, at the end of the day, the vets and nurses that are in that consulting room are really not there thinking, right, how much money am I going to make in this one? You know, I mean, it's really not, it's not about that for them. And so I think that solution-based, problem-solving-based approach is just a really nice way of kind of thinking about it. Obviously, you've kind of worked in, you know, multiple different areas within the profession, in multiple different geographic locations, which is going to be, you know, just give you this really interesting perspective on our profession. I wonder if you would mind sharing, they don't have to be from Glasgow, but I wonder if you would mind sharing, if they are, it's better. No, I'm joking. I wonder if you mind sharing who has inspired you along the way.
Inspired me through my profession, I guess, because there's always many different people who can inspire you for different reasons. It's a totally different one at the moment. I was reading Dodie Weir's book and I thought he's really inspirational based on kind of what he faced and how he faced it and how he's changed the world around MND. So I think in that respect, as a person who has really achieved a huge amount and left a huge legacy, I think he's quite an inspiration. In relation to the profession, my sister, who I followed through vet school, she was 9 years ahead of me. And then my nephew, actually, he was at my graduation. He was 5 weeks old. He has now graduated, which makes me feel ancient.
Has he? Is that right? From which vet school?
He went to Edinburgh. So my brother-in-law went to Edinburgh, and my nephew went to Edinburgh, but I went to Dublin, which we argue is obviously the best. So there's good plenty of family debates.
Oh, that's wonderful. And he was 5 weeks old at your graduation. What a wonderful story.
Yes.
And then and he's now working, he's now graduated.
He just started, yes. So I think there's a few different people. I think also there's a call out for me for somebody within the business, actually. So Stephanie Armstrong, she is the VP, Vice President for our, what we call our cluster. So basically she heads up the UK, Ireland, the Nordics and Benelux regions. So her career path, actually, she started off as a vet as well. We qualified, I think, more or less at the same time. So what she has achieved and how she's achieved it, I think she, for me, is quite an inspiration, because she's probably, well, she is the first female, actually, I've had to kind of look to and say, oh, well, because usually you're seeing other people in those positions of seniority. So I think that, for me...
Men.
Yeah, yeah.
It's true. Yeah. It's true though, isn't it? Yeah, so. I mean, that's, and I think to, and actually that, I love that, you know, that comes back to this idea of you don't see it, you know, you can't be it.
Yeah.
And just having that visualization of someone doing something that you're like, oh, well, that's, there we go. We can do that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And it's totally about that. It's if you don't know it exists, you don't know to look for it. And if you're not exposed to it, are you ever going to pursue it? I've been lucky. I've stumbled across things, but that's fluke. It kind of seeing people in positions or seeing people do stuff that you can relate to makes you think, actually, I didn't think that was necessarily, I didn't think it wasn't achievable, but I just didn't think it was, if you know what I mean. That seems a bit pre-intern.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So. No, totally. Yeah, totally. Yeah, no, that's it. That was a nice spectrum of inspiration there. I like that. I was glad you mentioned your family. I thought that was important. No, so that was good. So as far as kind of then, you know, the breadth of experience you've had, if you were to, you know, looking back now, you know, thinking about a piece of advice that you think would be important, maybe even for those, I don't know, maybe to your nephew who is now in the position you were in however many years ago, you know, what piece of advice would you give to them regarding navigating this?
Yeah, career? I would say try different things. And if you have a clear intent of what you want to do, which equally is not a bad thing, if you don't achieve it, don't see failure as a kind of an end point. I could put my hand up. I failed many the time at vet school. And I think it was the making of me, because I realized you do go on. So if you have a path that you want to pursue and you don't necessarily quite make it, don't think that's the end. Try different things, because you don't necessarily know what you like if you've never tried it. So, and I mean that from a career perspective, just broaden your experience so that you don't continue down a certain route for a prolonged period of time and then realize, actually, is this what I want forever? Have a broad experience, and if something comes up that you're curious about, dig a bit deeper. So I think that's whenever we talk about development within the business, I always say to the team, there's obviously what you know, and then there's what you may want to in the future, but then there's always that blind spot of stuff you have no idea of. So try to seek that out. Be curious about other things, and whether you pursue it or not isn't necessarily the key thing. It's just understanding what else is out there that I may actually be interested in. If I'd been told that when I qualified in 2000 that I would work as a a vet in industry, I wouldn't even known what that meant. And I would probably have dismissed it if somebody had explained it to me. But I was lucky to end up through going through the route I did, end up in this position and really enjoy it. But I wouldn't have known that at the time. So I think in reflection, it's if an opportunity comes up, investigate, be curious. If things don't work out, it's not a failure. If you go into something that you actually don't like, there is no problem in parking it and saying, actually, this isn't what I like, but there's so many other parts of the profession that I could look into. And there will always be something that delivers on your interest. And everybody's interest isn't the same. So there's no one right job that defines you as a vet.
Mm-hmm. And if you were to go back to the point of, applying to vet school and making that application to Dublin Vet School, would you still put that application in? Would you still pursue that career in veterinary medicine?
Yes, I would. I don't have any regrets. I might necessarily have, not everything would have worked out perfectly. I failed at that time. It's tough. I failed again. It was tough, but I am continuing to learn. And I think that's possibly something that vets enjoy, is learning and being challenged. Mm-hmm. And then if you find yourself having reached that in whatever part of your career, there will always be areas that you can tap into to continue that kind of challenging learning perspective. So mm-hmm. I wouldn't change it for any other profession. I think we've got such a broad opportunity with a veterinary degree that we're quite lucky, but it's just finding what's right for you. I think that's the key thing.
Yeah. And then finally, I wonder if you would share with us what you would like to be when you grow up.
When I grow up, that could be quite a while away. I think I do always have that idea of whenever you're in first year vet school, you think the final years know everything. And then you get to final year and you think those in practice know everything. And then when you're in practice, you think the boss knows everything, and maybe that you become the boss and you're thinking. So you're always kind of feeling you're never that mature person, or maybe that's just me. But when I was little, I wanted to be the physio for a football team. And I also got a scholarship to be a footballer in America, which is quite a...
Did you?
Yeah. I was quite a tomboy. So quite a different career. So I was mad about the Irish football team at the time.
Well, listen, I mean, that's... Women's football's like...
It was huge. It's huge in America.
Is the thing now, isn't it? Like that's...
Yeah. My fitness probably wouldn't let me through these days, though. I think that's the one thing.
It's funny, actually, that I'm not into football at all, but the one thing that, united our family was, is women's football in a way. Like I would sit and watch that and really be into it and feel really inspired by it, and in a way that I've never been inspired by kind of sport. You know what I mean? Like it was mm-hmm. a really funny yeah. thing about it, really, really inspiring. Like I thought, this is something really brilliant, you know what I mean? And like I say, I'm not into football at all, but that certainly is a really inspiring thing. Anyway, yeah. Do you still play football now or not?
Oh gosh, anymore? No. I wish. I hardly get up off this seat, which is the worst thing ever. But yeah, I'm very much.
I can hardly stand anymore. But just yeah, exactly. That's the other thing that maybe the industry does to you, is that you're now sitting on the computer.
Yes, I did get warned when I joined Pfizer. They talked about the Pfizer pounds, but I think now that's
important. Oh, stones. that's funny, actually. That when I worked. So I did telemedicine for IDEX, and so there was a big American team, and obviously we were just on the phones all day, and we would join calls with the American colleagues, and they would be on treadmills, on these calls, and we would take the piss, and I'd be like, oh, that's ridiculous. But actually, honestly, I was like, maybe I'll get a treadmill, because you're so stationary, you know what I mean? Like, and I think that, it's people talk about 10,000 steps. I mean, I'd hardly get to 10 steps, yeah. just to the toilet and back. You know what I mean? So I think
this could cover your back.
The Pfizer pounds are yeah, exactly. I can't think of anything that rhymes with Zoetis that would be to do with weight. Let's think about that. But anyway, but yeah, no, it's a real thing. Anyway, well, listen, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to us today. Really interesting. And I hope that, you know, people are inspired to consider, you know, if nothing else, just to look at other roles and to think about other opportunities that are available to them. And I think also just, you know, I think one of the messages that I think is really important is that we're, you know, there's lots of problems in the profession, but we're all part of that solution. Yeah. And everyone is really ultimately has the same sort of goal, regardless of whether you're working in industry or in practice or wherever. You know, we're all working towards the same thing. Yeah. So I think important that we remember that and work together as much as we can. So, but thank you so much for taking the time to chat to us.
No problem. Thanks, Scott. It was a pleasure.
A massive thank you again to Edwina for chatting today. Really, really fascinating conversation, and another really powerful insight into the amazing options that we have career-wise with our veterinary passport. We're going to launch into our clinical discussion now with another member of the lovely team from Zoetis, Louise, and we're going to be chatting about all things parasite-related. Right, well, listen, Louise, thanks so much for joining us today for this special series of podcast discussions. I think really importantly, we'll start for the listeners just with you introducing yourself and just telling us a little bit about you and what you do.
Sure, thank you. So I'm the National Veterinary Manager in the UK for companion animal parasite and vaccine products, which is a bit of a mouthful. But in summary, I look after the parasite and vaccine portfolio for companion animals that we have. And by look after, I mean from a veterinary point of view, because I'm a vet myself. I make sure all the clinical information that we send out is correct. I work with our marketeer on our materials. I work with our international and global teams on product development. So all across the spectrum of interaction with colleagues.
Gosh, but that does sound like, as you were saying that, I was like, that sounds like quite an important job and actually quite a lot, you know, quite a big remit. You know, there's a lot of really important stuff there. And I think when I was thinking about the what we're kind of discussing today, which we'll kind of introduce, the sort of overarching topic is the responsible use of parasiticides, if I said that right. Oh my god, parasiticides. Yeah. I think that's right. And in dermatology, but actually even taking out the vaccines, you know, even just parasiticides, it's something that, you know, these are products that we're using as veterinary surgeons and veterinary nurses and veterinary professionals every single day. But I suppose it's a, correct me if I'm wrong, it's still an area that's changing a lot. You know, is it something that we still, do we kind of know all we need to know when it comes to parasites? Or do you think that's something that is constantly evolving?
For sure, it's constantly evolving. I think when I was in practice, for 5 years I was in practice, and parasiticides and parasites just weren't exciting for me. I was excited about managing that complex diabetes case, or, you know, these kind of things. And I think that's still the case. However, as we've started talking more and more about responsible use of parasiticides, vets are now thinking, maybe I should have a little bit more of a read into these kind of things. And so that's part of our role at Zoetis, is to make sure that our customers, our vets, vet nurses, are using the products correctly. They know about the parasites that our products protect against, and the risks that we need to assess pets for, to know which animals need which product. And I think with parasiticides, that's where the knowledge can come, is how does the life cycle work, so that I know that that dog needs the prevention and that one probably doesn't, and that kind of thing. And I think as things evolve, not yet, but as things evolve with climate change and the vectors for some of these parasites, things will get more interesting, mm-hmm. because I think we'll have some new ones at some point mm-hmm. in the near mm-hmm. future.
I think there's lots of interesting things there. I think the first thing is that, you know, every single time that I, you know, sometimes, you know, people will come to me, you know, with referral medicine cases, and sometimes people will ask about sort of parasite control. And to be quite honest with you, that question I always find hard to answer, because I'm like, oh, you know, I don't feel up to date with that. So I think it genuinely is a topic that I feel like I can't just call on my knowledge from 10 years ago and be like, oh, do that, mm-hmm. you know, because there are products that people will mention now that I genuinely won't recognize, you know. So I think it is clearly an area that it's important that we keep up to date. And I think it's so interesting that you mention, you know, the change in our environment, but also apart from climate change and obviously, you know, changes in temperature and changes in vectors, we also have this element of, you know, dogs moving more, dogs and cats moving more, you know, dogs coming from places that we don't necessarily, you know, where the disease profile is different. So I think that there are new challenges that there wasn't, you know, sort of 10 years ago. So we hear, you know, so we're talking about parasite control, we're talking about, with a focus on dermatology, we often hear in veterinary medicine this kind of, let's call it a buzz phrase, you know, this one health approach where we have to think about animals and humans and the environment, and, you know, we feel like that's something we should be thinking about. Why is that particularly important or relevant when it comes to talking about parasite control, particularly in dermatology?
So the One Health concept, when it comes to parasites and parasiticides, is really interesting, because we've kind of got that, as you mentioned, it's like a triangle. I think of it as a triangle. We've got the environment, the human, and the pet. And us as vets, primarily, we are responsible for the pet and their welfare. However, by doing so, we impact the environment potentially, and also the human as well, either positively or negatively. So although we only cover one part directly, what we do with that one part, the pet, impacts the other two points of the triangle. And there's a lot of discussion about the environment at the moment with regards to parasiticide use. And that gets a lot of airtime, and people are talking about it quite rightly. We want to make sure that what we are doing with the medicines that we use are not impacting the environment negatively. Equally, we do have to make sure that we are using those products correctly in the pets that need those products. And also for the human side of it, some of the parasites that pets can get are zoonotic, or they will carry zoonotic diseases. And also the impact on the human-animal bond if a pet has parasites. So owners are disgusted if they find tapeworm segments on their cat, for example, or if they get an infestation of fleas in their home. It's such a close relationship between all those points of the triangle. It's a really interesting part of veterinary medicine, I think.
It's funny, actually, because I've got two things to share there. First of all, you know, some non-veterinary friends of mine shared very recently in a group chat on WhatsApp that they had, their pet had got fleas, and they were absolutely, I mean, the level of devastation, I can't even begin to tell you. And actually my cat, we've just moved from the UK to Canada, and my cat, I thought, was up to date with everything, and actually did leave a tapeworm segment on the surface of my mobile phone as he was sitting at my desk.
Oh no.
I was on the phone to my friend who actually edits the podcast, and I was like, Karen, I'm going to have to go because I think there's a tapeworm like moving on my, honestly, I've never been so disgusted in my life. Anyway, this is real life. Yes. This is real life stuff. Yes. Saw a really interesting thing actually the other day. It was more about antibiotics, and you know, I was listening to someone lecture about antimicrobial resistance, and I was just amazed about that, you know, talking about that One Health topic, about the fact that, you know, we're not just thinking about the impact of giving an animal a certain drug. You know, we're talking about the impact of, you know, when that animal pees and poos, you know, what happens to that pee and poo, the stuff that ends up in the waterways, you know, the stuff that then ends up in having impacts on the environment that we just never would think about. And so I think, you know, it's so important to think it's not just that moment where we're giving that animal that drug, that parasite control, whatever. There's such a wider impact that we don't always see. So I think, you know, generally responsible use of medications is so important. Mm. So then on that topic, why can we not? What would really help us in veterinary medicine? Because we're so busy. Is just having a one size fits all approach mm-hmm. to things mm-hmm. and being able to say, right, this dog is, you know, let's say this dog has got itchy skin and we want to get up to date with parasite prevention, can we not just adopt a one size fits all for cats and dogs where actually it's easy just to pick this thing off the shelf and that's going to deal with everything? I presume that's not the right approach. I don't know if you can share a little bit about why a one size maybe doesn't fit all.
Yeah.
When it comes to this sort of thing.
Definitely. If we think about it in the context of dermatology, which is the sort of theme that we're running through today, there is some element of one size fits all with the parasites that we deal with in dermatology, purely because fleas, Demodex, Sarcoptes, and to some degree Otodectes, depending on the product, can be killed by a single molecule. One molecule may act on all of those parasites. So we do have a one size fits all. So we don't need to choose one treatment for fleas, add on another one for mites, add on another one for Demodex, Sarcoptes, separate it all out. Where we do see the one size fits all, and it's interesting to hear when people talk about that, because I hear that sometimes when I talk with our vets in the field, but equally I hear the other side where people definitely don't want a one size fits all, and we want to be able to make it more specific, almost kind of a, if you've got this, you choose that. If you've got this as well, you choose that. I think for ectoparasites, certainly with the isoxazolines that were probably, we've had isoxazolines for about 10, 11, 12 years now in some form or another. They cover ectoparasites in dermatology that we would need to be covered. So that's fine. Some products now have wormers added in. So we, by using a product that has ecto and endo parasiticide function, we are covering the external worms, fleas, mites, ticks, and also then the worms as well. When it comes to worms, which worm do you need to cover for? Again, that depends on the pet's lifestyle and their risk factors. In dogs, we're looking at, do they need lungworm prevention? Do they need Toxocara prevention monthly or quarterly? Do they need tapeworm prevention monthly, quarterly, or maybe even less frequently? Worms are kind of more of a, you have to think about your worm and cover a little bit more. But what can help in practice is having a set of questions or a decision tree to help you assess that pet's lifestyle to know what products they may need for their lifestyle. And that's something that certainly we make at Zoetis. We've got an assessment form that can help you choose which product you need. It doesn't steer you to our product every time. It's important to point out. So it is a clinically relevant piece. And other companies as well, they've got assessment forms in some guise. Some are very owner friendly. Others are more vet facing. Depends on which one you look at. And that helps you, because everybody's pushed for time. There really isn't enough time to discuss everything. That can help just make that conversation a bit quicker and get to the key points that you need to talk about with that owner about their pet.
And I think people are looking, actually, that's a really good point. Like, I think owners are looking for, they're not looking for one size fits all. Owners are really keen on, you know, providing bespoke treatments for their pets that are relevant to their pets. They don't want to, people are really, I think, more conscious nowadays of not overusing drugs. You know, they question, I think, a lot more medications and why they're being prescribed. And so I do think it's relevant to come up with that kind of bespoke approach. And I definitely think that some sort of form that fills out, or some sort of tree, I love that, decision-making tree, if that exists, that sounds good. You know, as far as, you know, helping to come to that sort of decision. Apart from that kind of piece around decision-making with these drugs, why is it so important that we are educating owners about using these products appropriately and as they're meant to be used? And I can draw on some personal, I'm such a terrible pet owner, I can draw on some personal experience here where, you know, I get quite flustered by sometimes using, like, I had to do a spot on thing the other day or whatever. I mean, I can't deal with that. Because one of my cats is bald as well. And I'm like, I'm just seeing this product running everywhere. Right. It's not really working.
Yeah.
So and then having to tablet anyway. So why is it important that we are, when we are giving these products, we're giving them properly?
Yeah. So the administration is one segment of that. Also, choosing the correct product in the first place. If the owner comes to us, we can absolutely guide them on that. We can tell them which product is most appropriate for their pet, be that the type of cover they need, whether that's going to be an oral medication that acts systemically or a topical product that you spot on and then that acts topically. So it doesn't get into the bloodstream, it stays on the coat oils or whatever. So there's the product itself, and then there's the actual administration of the product. And then after that comes disposal of packaging as well. So all that is encompassed in correct use for the owner. If they come to us at the veterinary clinic about that, we can advise them on that. If they buy their product completely with no interaction with anyone, for example, from the supermarket or from an online shop, then there's certain online pharmacies that, it depends on the category of parasiticide where you do need to interact with someone, but some products don't need any interaction at all. And you're relying on the owner reading the label, which we can't rely on owners reading labels even when we show them the label. I remember in practice, I would, you know, put the label under their face, like give every 12 hours of antibiotics or whatever, and they didn't do that. So we're relying on asking owners a lot. But we've got to choose the correct product in the first place, because for dermatology, it's so important. If you've got a dog that has pyoderma, but also needs flea cover, and that dog is getting washed frequently, definitely want to be using a systemic product for that dog, because if you use a spot-on product, it's just going to get washed off, not be effective, and potentially be, leading that product to be in the waterways if you're washing them too much. Then giving the product correctly, so really guiding the owner on how to administer the medication. Does it have to be given with or without food? In some cases, that matters. It will affect the absorption of the product, therefore the efficacy may be affected if it's not given with food. For spot-on products, telling the owner how to apply those. And then showing them, I think, is really helpful. You see it, you know what you're doing. And then afterwards, we get questions come through to us from owners directly. Can I recycle, product packaging or pipettes? And we need to be careful that people aren't trying to be too conscious of the environment and rinsing out packets of spot on pipettes or something, and then all that's going down the sink. There's lots of areas that we need to help owners just to sort of signpost how to recycle or dispose of that packaging as well.
That's really interesting, because I obsessively wash my recycling, mm-hmm. And I get teased about that, I think, but I do, so that's, and I can see owners like cutting the ends off things and like rinsing things out. And so I don't want to go too much off topic. So, is that advice that you give out then? So owners want to recycle these packagings of anti-parasite, drugs, mm-hmm. or whatever, is that something that you help with? Can you give advice on that?
Yeah, I mean, some of the packaging, the outer box, the inner leaflet can be recycled. It's cardboard paper. It hasn't come into contact with the product, so that's fine. The difficulty comes with things like blister packets of tablets or with plastic pipettes that have had active ingredient in them. At the moment in the UK, and I can only speak for the UK, but the disposal regulations and instructions, not just for our products, but across the board for animal medicines, often you'll see on the packet or the label, it will say dispose of in accordance with local authority regulations or guidelines, which means ask your local council. And in some ways, a lot of the time, they don't know how those products need to be disposed of correctly. So that is a bit of a grey area at the moment, which hopefully can be addressed in the near future. But there is work ongoing to try and help guide owners to do the right thing with their waste.
But something that we, important that we're having that conversation then with them, because they may ask that question. And, we don't always have the best answer, but at least we have some guidance we can give. So I think that's all really, it's really interesting actually. Now I've got, I had some help with some of the questions that we were discussing today, because this is, an area that's so out with my comfort zone. So thankfully I had some guidance. I must admit, when I'm reading this last question, I don't actually know what all of it means, which is even more reason to ask the question. So we're just a final sort of question about the regulations. So I'll read out here. So the regulations under the theme of how animal medications and authorized and ongoing PV monitoring. And when we were speaking before, I was like, I don't know what PV stands for. So maybe you can explain a little bit about, first of all, what that means, and then we can talk about the relevance of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think when you work in certain sections of the industry, you get your acronyms and you become so used to those and you just use those. And that's one that when I talk to people about it, that's probably one that people ask a lot. What does that mean? So I should be more careful with that. But PV stands for pharmacovigilance. And that means ongoing monitoring of adverse events and user exposure after the product is launched. So this would be, ages ago, when I was in practice, this was filling in the yellow form in the back of the note compendium. But now we don't have paper. You don't make the compendiums anymore in paper form. It's all online. So you can report an adverse event to either the pharmaceutical company themselves. So we're all obliged to receive that information and deal with it in an appropriate time frame to make sure that anything that's a serious adverse event gets flagged immediately. So that's a legal obligation on all the pharmaceutical companies. You can also report it to the VMD, the Veterinary Medicines Directorate, directly. And they're the ones who actually collate all that information. So they're independent of all the pharmaceutical companies. But every so often, we as a pharmaceutical company send them our reports and incidence rates, and they collate all the information. And then they see whether anything flags up. It's called a signal. So if there is something that's coming up very frequently that would be unusual and not what we would expect, then that raises a flag that needs to be addressed. So that, to me, provides great reassurance that the products that are licensed for use in the UK are being monitored ongoing. And that's such a reassurance, because if there are any issues, then that will get noticed. But it really relies on vets reporting those adverse events. That's why it's so important. I know that it takes time out of your day and it is really awkward. But even if you have a small amount of information, just send that over. So we've got a customer support email that you can send to us for our products, and all the other animal health companies will have the same. I think one misconception is that you don't need to be sure whether it was the product or not, even if you just have a suspicion. It's called a suspect adverse event. So you don't have to decide. That's up to us or the VMD to decide the causality. So don't worry about that. Just send it. And that includes resistance, suspected resistance to parasiticides, suspected environmental contamination, and the things that you would classically think of as an adverse event, like, you know, vomiting after administering a tablet, for example.
I think actually it's a really important topic. And just again, I think, like you say, just that reassurance that you don't have to be certain that there's causality. You know, I think I had someone asked me some advice recently about a drug and some sort of very odd mild side effects, but she'd seen it in two different patients. And I that was the first thing I said. I said, first of all, you need to phone the drug company, because they may be able to help you a little bit. Yeah. But second of all, it's really important that they know that information. Yeah. And I think second of all, that what you mentioned there about resistance, you know, there was, I did deal with one case where we ended up treating a parasite was the cause of the clinical signs. It wasn't dermatological. But actually, one of the things the owner was saying was, well, I've given appropriate preventative medicine. Why is my, you know, dog got this disease? It could have been lungworm or something, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And actually, that was the first thing again. I said, well, we need to speak to the drug company about this, because they, first of all, they're going to really want to know.
Yes.
And second of all, they're going to really want to know. Like, I think they're not going to be like all defensive and be like, oh, you know, I'm really, you know, that's, I can't believe our product. You know, it's not about that. It's about actually just gathering important information.
Yeah.
And if it is true that there was resistance, then we absolutely need to know about it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think we don't think about drug resistance with parasite control the same way we do about antimicrobial resistance. We're only just, you know, getting our heads around antimicrobial resistance, but we have to remember that antimicrobial drugs are not the only drugs that fall foul of resistance, you know, and I think that's really, really important. So I think just, just reporting and having that conversation with whichever company, I think is really valuable.
Yeah. And it's worth pointing out, certainly for the UK, it is different in America, but in the UK, there's no documented resistance to any of the actives that we use for companion animal parasites at the moment. But we want to know if there are any challenges. So that's why, like you say, it's so important to report those. In America, it's slightly different. They have some issues with some of the worms over there. So we want to know if there's anything happening in the UK. We need to know about it, definitely.
Really important. Well, listen, as always, you know, I feel like we said the last time we had a conversation that, people are scathing of dermatology. You know, it's not always the most, people don't always think it's the most interesting thing, but I always think that these discussions are so interesting and so many things that come up that I certainly don't think about, and I think people will find so useful. So I think it's thank you so much for sharing some of that today. Really, really valuable, super interesting. And as always, you've made dermatology fun for me. So massive thank you to Edwina and Louise, a massive thank you to Zoetis, a massive thank you to you always for supporting and listening. I'm always blown away by that and really truly appreciate the support that you give us. To learn more about VTX and what we do, please do head over to the show notes or our website, which is www.vtx-cpd.com. And I really look forward to seeing you and chatting next time.